Well, friends, welcome to another installment of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We're so excited to share this time with you, to share this guest with you today. Today, we have the pleasure of chatting with Aaron Nyquist. Aaron was the worship pastor, I believe, at Mars Hill in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when Rob Bell was there. He was the worship pastor at Willow Creek. Aaron and I connected on this rooftop gathering in Manhattan and shared this really lovely time talking about the Brewers and the Cubs. It's just a terrible flaw.
All right, move it along, Randy.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I just found him to be really, really kind, really, really generous, genuinely wondering about who you are and what your world is, and just a fascinating guy who went from the evangelical world, right in the epicenter of the evangelical world, to an Episcopalian seminary in Manhattan. And that confluence of those two streams is really fascinating to me and really rich in him. And he's not cynical. He's not trying to like go to one while hating on the other. There's just a lot of generosity and goodness in him, and I'm super excited to share this conversation.
Yeah, and we're discussing his book that came out about 3 years ago called The Eternal Current. There's a podcast based on that book as well, but lots of other stuff too.
Yeah,
that came up in the conversation.
Yep. So if you're new to this show, we are a pastor and a philosopher walking to a bar. So we do a tasting of a delicious beer or whiskey or anything really. And Kyle, you're providing the goodness today. What are we drinking?
Yeah, so this is another installment from Eagle Park Brewing Company in Milwaukee.
One of our favorites.
One of my favorite brewers. I'm a proud member. And this is one of my favorite beers that they make, has been for a long time. It's kind of a gimmicky beer. It's one of those things with lots of adjuncts added to it, kind of fruit.
I judge it.
But it's delicious. It's delicious. So this is a milkshake IPA. So we're all familiar with IPAs, right? Milkshake just means they add lactose to it. So this is kind of a New England style IPA with milk sugar added. And then they also add fruit to this one. So this is, we have two versions of it here, actually. We have one that's 5.6% alcohol and another that is 9%.
Whoa.
But it's the same beer. There's just an imperial version of it. So we're going to taste both side by side and see which one we prefer.
So
this is called Bottoms Up is the regular, and then Big Bottoms is the Imperial.
So we're all drinking first now, the Big Bottoms, right?
Yeah, yeah, this is the strong one.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right.
So this has blood orange, mango, and, blood orange, tangerine, and vanilla.
That's amazing. That is delicious. I mean, I used to roll my eyes and say things like, good God, when you talk about adjuncts and milkshakes and lactose and, you know, all that.
Me too, man.
I'm
me
wrong.
Too, right there with
like,
you.
Now, you just roll your beer.
Yeah, the purest in, yeah, exactly. The purest in me hates that shit.
Yeah.
But man, it's delicious. And I mean, it's not flavored coffee. That's what I have to keep reminding myself. It's not like Gloria Jean's hazelnut coffee. It's much better.
The Highlander grog of beers.
Right. Yeah, man. Yeah.
No, I think it's a it's not a great beer. It's just a delicious smoothie. But I love it.
I think it's both. I think it can be both.
Oh, it's a delicious beer.
Like most, you know, heavily fruited adjunct beers have a sour base, and this is an IPA base. Mm-hmm. And it just makes all the difference. It has that bitterness to it. It has the kick to it that you want from an IPA. The hop profile complements the actual fruit. I love it. It's delicious.
To me, so now I've gone from the Imperial, the Big Bottoms, to just the Bottoms Up.
Yep.
And I think I still like the Bottoms Up, the less alcoholic volume, better. It's just brighter. It's a little lighter on the on the palate, and it feels like I could drink too many of these on a patio on a warm summer day. It's just delicious.
Yeah.
Oh, this is one of my favorite beers. This is probably my favorite beer I've had since King Sue.
Right? Yeah. This was a go-to for me. Loving it.
If you're in the Midwest or anywhere and you see Eagle Park beer on the shelf,
do it.
Just buy it.
Yeah.
I'm on Bottoms Up now as well.
Yeah.
And I like Big Bottoms, and
I knew
I
you
cannot
would.
Lie.
I knew you would.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
On that note,
Eagle Park, Big Bottoms, and Bottoms Up. Cheers, you did it.
Nice.
Cheers.
Aaron Nyquist, thank you so much for joining us on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walking to a Bar.
Glad to be here.
So one thing we like to ask our guests before we get rolling, because we're a pastor and a philosopher walking to a bar, is, are you drinking anything you want to tell us about?
I don't know if I need to tell you about it. I'm just drinking a quite mediocre red wine.
That's good.
And
that's
good. But good way to end the day.
Yeah. So Thursday. Yes. Thursday night. That's
nothing,
good.
Nothing to remark upon, though.
Good. All right. So, yeah. Aaron, can you tell our listeners, the few who don't know about you and your world and what you do and where you are, could you just tell us about your world?
Yeah. So currently living in Manhattan in the Chelsea neighborhood. And we had moved here 3 years ago for me to become a student at General Theological Seminary to get my master's. And we absolutely love it here. And so we are trying to find every way to stay. And so this year, I graduated last spring. And so this year, I've been jumping into a number of different things, a couple different communities here in Chelsea. And it's mostly at the intersection of like music and art and formation, and maybe throw liturgy in there. So the things that we do together that help form us into the way of Christ.
Nice. So you're now a master of theology? I have about 100 questions.
I feel like a master of nothing. But yes, I did take those courses.
I can't remember the name of the school that you just said, but is what affiliation or denomination?
It's an Episcopal school.
Okay.
And it's actually a real historic, apparently the story is, before General was built like 100 and something years ago, you had to actually go over to the UK to become a priest. And so they built this seminary to train Episcopal priests for the States. So I'm not Episcopalian, but loving being a part of a new and strange tradition, strange to me, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Cool. So we had a look at your book before the interview. Thanks for sending over to
absolutely.
Us. So in the book that you wrote that came out, 3 years ago, something like that, The Eternal Current?
Yeah, right around then. Yep.
Yeah. So at the beginning of that, you relay a story about your doubting process that began around 2002 and the journey you've been on since then of transforming your view of what Christian practice is. So can you give our listeners sort of a Cliff's Notes version of that story?
Yeah. Maybe a better way to say it is my first doubting experience.
Yeah, yeah.
one of many on the cycle of belief and unbelief. But I had grown up in a Christian family, Christian college, and then got a job at a Christian church. And then about like a year in, I'm a worship leader. I realize I barely believe any of the songs that I'm asking people to sing. And it was, it was 15 years ago now. So it's easy to look back and talk about because you know how it goes, but it was a terrifying moment, both professionally, like, what am I going to do? But way deeper, like this was like deconstructing like grandma's house. Like this is how I grew up. This is everything I knew. And it was very scary. And, the long and the short of it is broke me out of some things that had died a long time ago. And so when I look back, I'm so grateful for that moment. But again, it's easy to talk about the positive outcome. But when you're in it, it's just like a punch to the gut.
Yeah, so many of us can identify with that exact moment, that experience. In the book, as you described your faith crisis, Aaron, you mentioned how each person's journey is unique, but this wrestling and this ache and maybe even this kind of moments of doubt and uncertainty and unbelief is universal, you say. Can you explain that? Because I think of, and I'm perplexed by some people, not perplexed, but I just wonder about some people that I know who, in my family or in my church or whatever, who have this a little bit more fundamentalist rooted kind of faith journey that doesn't give a hint of doubt or uncertainty or shaky ground with your faith. And I just don't know what to make of it. Do you really think it is universal?
Absolutely. It makes me think of the writer of the book of Romans talking about all creation groans. And I truly think there is a universal, not just Christian people, all creation groans. The world is not how it was meant to be. We know this. There is more. We know this or desperately want to know this. So I think the ache is universal. certainly you're naming that we're all at a different place on the process mm-hmm. of getting in touch with that ache. We humans are spectacular at ignoring reality, even our own reality. And so I think some people haven't got there yet. And then some don't ever get there. I can think of a couple people in my life who made it into their 70s, never allowing some of those cracks to see the light of day. And, you know, a lot of times that comes out of trauma, that comes out of growing up in a house where you were never allowed to ask a question or show weakness. But what a loss for them to have to hold together something they know is not the whole story, but it's unthinkable to start over.
Yeah. One of our friends and former guest, Brian McLaren, would call that simplicity. And I do think, like you're saying, some people are really content, and not only content, desperately hold on to that simplicity. Like complexity, perplexity seems terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I let one crack show, the whole thing, you know, crumbles. And that's terrifying. I mean, we just have to empathize with that. That's a really scary thought of losing the whole thing.
Especially when it's like concretely, I will lose my job.
Not
just what I believe, but concrete, like how I make a living.
My job, all my relationships, my family relationship. And then depending on how anchored, you know, your faith is in more fundamentalist or even conservative sides, you know, we're talking eternity. Do I want to burn in the lake of fire, or do I want to float on a cloud? I mean, that's like, those are some stakes right there. Yeah. So, and I'm not being glib about it. That is what many of us are taught. Those are stakes. Yeah. So this is not to be engaged with lightly.
Hmm. Yeah. So when you had that initial crisis experience or doubting experience or whatever, how long would you say you were in a period of pretending, or because you didn't stop being a worship leader, right? You
just right. Well, for good and for bad, and this is some of my Enneagram 4, I'm a terrible pretender.
Yeah.
My wife would say I have zero poker face. And again, that causes a lot of tumult in my life, but I also think it's can be a positive. So I was not able to pretend very long. I'm really bad with the big smile. But I did have a job to do. And so thankfully I had a boss, the pastor at the time, that I could tell, like, share this with. Mm. And he was walking with me. And even one night he said, you know what? It seems like this might not be the best thing for you to do. I used to play guitar back in my early days. Let me do the songs tonight, and then you can just have the week off. I mean, it's just so profoundly meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning as I talk to other friends, unbelievably rare.
Yeah.
Most people in my position admit to a fraction of a doubt and then are working at Starbucks. And, you know, what does that say about our churches? That, you know, it's all fine as long as you believe everything. And then if you even question anything, you're out.
Yeah.
This is a tragedy.
Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons why we see crazy declining numbers of young people leaving the church, leaving the faith. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be. That's what drives me absolutely bonkers.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the book, maybe this is the thesis of the book, actually, you write that Christianity is a practice-based faith. Most of the book is taken up describing what those practices are. So what does that mean? And how is it different from how most Christians understand, or at least a lot of the Christians that we've grown up around, right? The Christians that were in your church who view it as more of a belief system or something.
Yeah, great question. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, a collection of Jesus' greatest teachings, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, Jesus says the famous, if you build your house on the rock and all that. I sang the song in Sunday school. I knew that whole like thing. But I didn't realize that what Jesus is actually saying is, if you hear my words and put them into practice, you are like a man who builds his house upon the rock. if you hear my words and don't put them into practice, you're like a man who builds his house upon the sand. And that to me was scandalous, because what I had heard is if you hear Jesus' words and believe they're true and say a correct prayer about them, then you're building your life on the rock. Mm-hmm. If you just believe it really strongly, if you align your brain and your thinking, you're in. And I think beliefs matter. I think it matters what we believe, but that's just not the invitation of Jesus. Jesus didn't say, here is some truth, believe it. Mm-hmm. Jesus said, I am the truth, follow me. And so that has just been, the implications for that, for me at least, are vast. So, you know, you take something simple like, well, not simple, let's say, how do I begin not going all the way in? I mean, you take something like gossip, you know, spiritual teachers and the scriptures don't say, don't gossip or God will punish you. They say, don't gossip because it'll wreck your relationships. So it's not like, oh, I better believe gossip is bad. It's inviting us into the best way to live. Dallas Willard says, Jesus' teachings are not observations about what should happen. They're simple observations about how the universe actually works. And so I think the invitation is not to believe correctly. It's to join Christ in the way that Jesus has invited us to be.
It's beautiful. It's good. So within, you know, you with other friends kind of pioneered a new kind of expression within an evangelical megachurch that you were working at, and you called it the practice, right? And you said you had three kind of main focuses of each gathering. And I get paid, you know, one of the things I get paid to do is to preach sermons and to, you know, teach the Bible and all that stuff. And you say when you're talking about the practice, you say that you describe teaching that leads to practice is the kind of teaching that you were trying to bring about in the practice, in this gathering. Teaching that leads to practice. Now, being my cynical self, I just want to be like, well, that just sounds like preaching that has a call to action. But what, tell me, is there something different about teaching that leads to practice than a normal sermon?
Yeah, that's great. I think the core of it is, what is the intention of that time?
Okay.
There are many times that I've heard a sermon and frankly given a sermon where the takeaway truly is, if you peel everything back, the takeaway is, I want you to believe these things that I'm telling you. Mm-hmm. So the end goal, wow, people agreed or believed or even shifted their mind. And again, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm anti-teaching. I think teaching has an incredible role to play unless it sees itself as the end.
Okay.
And then I think it can be really unhelpful. But a teaching that leads to practice is more of a springboard. The end goal is not, all right, are we clear? Everybody believe that? Mm-hmm. The end goal is, are you now empowered to do that? Mm-hmm. Tuesday morning or Wednesday afternoon or Thursday. So an example that I love to use because it's been so kind of provocative in my life and then really helpful is the whole idea of forgiving those who have wounded us. I've heard so many sermons on forgiveness. Thank God, because it's one of the central themes of a healthy Christian spirituality. But just hearing a sermon that tells me I should forgive so-and-so, if that's the end goal, then not only does it not help me, it actually makes me feel worse because I don't know how to do it. Hmm. But if we do... if we teach about why it's so central, so this is why teaching is so important, but then also give people the tools to do it, I think it's revolutionary. Quick story. I was meeting with my spiritual director. He's a Jesuit priest. I was telling him there's someone in my life that I like was thinking about how I could yell at them. You know, really a lot of resentment. And we talked about forgiveness. He told me the things that I knew, but good reminders. And then he said, Aaron, we have a four-step practice that helps pray these prayers and release this person to God. Can I tell you about it? And I'm like, sure. So he told me the four steps, and I was like, oh man, I could actually do that. So I told him, you know, this week I'm going to find some time to do this prayer. And he goes, let's do it now. And I'm like, no, I'm not ready now. But he's like, let's do it now. Mm-hmm. And so we spent the next 15 or 20 minutes practicing this prayer of releasing this person. And it was difficult, and I didn't mm-hmm. like it, but it was beautiful. And then I walked out, not only knowing I should forgive this person, not only having an experience of beginning to crack my fists open just a little bit, but now I had a four-step practice that I could put Jesus' words into practice all week long. And honestly, I've prayed that 200 times since then mm-hmm. for that particular person and for a number of other situations. So
yeah. It's actually goes back a long way. I don't expect at all that you would remember this, but it was probably a decade ago that we met for the first time. And I came and I asked if you would have lunch. I was working at a mega church at the time. You were in Chicago area at the mega church that you were working at. And in my role, I identified
yes,
a lot with
we what, met. Yeah. We met in between, right?
Yeah, we did.
I remember driving up. Yeah.
So
yeah.
But the
yeah.
thing that made me reach out to you for that first time was I was in a role where it was my job to, you know, to produce the Sunday spectacle in a way that would bring people in, right. To figure out how to create something compelling that would direct people to that, you know, bring them to the foot of the pulpit yep. in a way where then they were receptive to the sermon. And then when the sermon's over, you close it out with,
yep.
a good emotional piece that's gonna, drive right. those words home. So,
yep.
From that reality, what I saw was you searching or exploring these ways of creating these gatherings where you talk about practice-based, but it's like the connection that was really helpful for me is it's like a rehearsal. Like we're actually, we're going through these things as a community. And I started to see and understand like there's something different to our gatherings than spectacle. Yeah. And maybe there's an appropriate center point other than the sermon. As you've spent a lot of time developing those types of thoughts and then flowing gatherings yeah. out of those, what does that actually look like as a worship leader or whatever, yeah. whatever, break out of that box, whatever it is now that we can do instead?
Yeah.
What does that look like in the thought process and in the planning yep. and then in the execution of that type of a thing? It's different.
Yeah. Oh, great question. Well, I mean, the simple answer is I tried, like almost every page of the book is literally trying to wrestle that. But I'll tell a story and then maybe just a couple specifics. And I think I shared the story in the book. Imagine going to a fitness center and saying, I'm out of shape, but I signed up for the New York Marathon in 6 months. Would you help me get ready for this marathon? And imagine they said, wonderful, we'd love to help you. Come back to this back room. We have this band that's going to play a bunch of songs. And then we have a marathon expert who's going to give a lecture on running marathons.
Sounds way better than running.
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, so you go back there and the band is great and you're all fired up for running. And then the marathon runner gives you the three steps to how to run a marathon. And you're like, this was amazing. And then they say, come back next week, we'll do it again. Come back next week, we'll do it again. Come back next week. It won't take you very long to realize you are no closer to actually running the marathon than you were. You're inspired, you're fired up, and that has value. So I'm not anti the inspiration and even the let's talk about things. But at a certain point, someone would have to say, hey, come join me on the mat here. Let me teach you, you know, your hamstrings, they're going to take a beating. Let me teach you a couple stretches that help get your hamstrings strong enough to be able to run. All right, let's talk about aerobic. Let's talk. Okay, yeah, obviously the analogy breaks down at a certain point. But, you know, as my friend Mark Scandrett was the first one who I had heard start talking about church as gymnasium. We have churches as classroom. We have church as concert hall. We have church, I'm learning in these circles as kind of preservation society. But what I think the world desperately needs is church as gymnasium, where we learn how to put Jesus' words into practice. And so for us at the practice, the night was broken up in three parts. There was an opening liturgy that involved singing, that involved the scriptural text, prayers, prayer for the world, kind of what you'd imagine in a kind of Anglican, kind of evangelical, kind of progressive, kind of Catholic liturgy. Okay. And then the middle section was a teaching that led to a practice, like you had mentioned. And what it meant is we said the teaching can be 10 to 12 minutes, which for people who are used to preaching 45 is excruciating.
And just for done everyone, with my introduction.
right. And for everyone listening, it's such a gift. because in the world we live in, I'm not trying to like be controversial over, but like we don't learn best by large blocks of lecture. That's not how our brains are wired, especially in like the internet age. And so we learn by interaction. We learn by co-creation. We learn from smaller ideas. And then, okay, so. And so we said, you know, the teacher, you have one idea and it's got to propel us into then a practice, which then we'd spend 15 to 20 minutes doing the practice. So like the forgiveness example, we would talk about why forgiveness is so important, the scriptural grounding, a story that helps us. And then now go ahead and put your papers down. I want to guide you through this four-step practice. And then, so that was the middle movement. And then the final movement, we'd gather around the Eucharist table. And we'd break the bread and the wine, and then that would send us out into the world. And I would end every gathering with, remember, Sunday is not the main event. Your actual life is the main event. So this week, as you practice, remember this four-part forgiveness prayer. Is there someone you want to keep praying it for? And we'd like talk about how to propel into the world. So that's a little framework. Was that
good? Yeah.
Enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a perfect segue into the next question that I had for
you.
In the book, you seem to have really found a profound depth and transformational experience in the Eucharist itself, centering all of it in a very Catholic way. I love the Eucharist. I love centering in our practice. I would love to do it more. However, I haven't had that consistent, profound experience and encounter with the Eucharist in ways that my Catholic friends do and that your book describes.
Yeah.
I don't understand the idea of basing a whole gathering around the bread and the cup. So what am I missing? What makes that moment in practice so meaningful for you and millions of other people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the first place to start. I mean, because I grew up in the same way. We would do communion on occasion, and it was a meaningful way to remember what Jesus did. It was a memorial. It was looking back. At the best, I would spend some time thinking about my sin that put Jesus on the cross, and then thank Jesus for paying that price. So kind of in the substitutionary atonement centric way of believing. And there is some deep truth to that. But I think as I looked around to our fellow Christians of other streams, many, many traditions, I would say most traditions, Christian traditions, center the Eucharist. I mean, our Catholic friends, going to Mass is going to the table. That's why you go. And so it just, it kind of piqued my interest. Like, why, what's going on there? And I mean, I am only scratching the surface of this mystery. The book I would probably recommend is For the Life of the World by Alexander Schmemann. And he is an Orthodox Christian and talks about kind of the sacramental imagination of what is happening at the table and in the liturgy. It's a mind-blowing, bending book. Maybe I would say one thing, Ian Cron, has he ever been on your podcast?
We have not had him, no,
not yet.
That'd okay. be fun.
Just an awesome guy and was a evangelical pastor for many years and then became an Episcopal priest. And he came to the practice and did a whole night on the Eucharist. And it was the teaching, and then he walked us through every step of the Eucharistic liturgy. Here's why we do this. Here's why. I mean, it was just crazy. But the moment that stuck with us, right at the end, right as we were about to approach the table, he goes, "Now remember, you never take communion." And we're like, "What? Take? That's what we do." He goes, "It can only be received."
Wow.
He said, "Taking is what they did in the Garden of Eden. But receiving is what's going to put the whole world back together."
Okay.
And I mean, I remember just, there's just a hush. And he knew it. And yeah. We just sat in silence for a moment. And so there's something that's going on in the table that's not just thinking about what Jesus did, but is getting swept up in what Jesus does. There is a present reality. There is, you know, and obviously, is Jesus only present at the table? Of course not. God is everywhere. God fills, you know, it is in God. We live, move, and have our being. But I think there is something at the table that helps us become present to the presence of Christ that has been with us all along.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's StoryhillBKC.com. Support for this episode is in from Morley's Maple Syrup.
So we used the standard bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup that Morley's makes, and I figured it'd be best to mix it into an old-fashioned.
I would pay, I don't know if I would because I'm cheap, but this is like a $14 craft cocktail at some hipster mustache.
And, on a rooftop in New York.
Yeah. I've been to those places and paid that for those cocktails, and this is just as good as all.
Yeah. I mean, this syrup, A, I've had it on waffles and it's delicious. Mm-hmm. It's probably the best syrup I've ever had. And B, this is a dynamite cocktail. I would get a bottle of this Morley's maple syrup.
Just for this.
Bourbon aged, just for a cocktail. Yeah,
there's a super complex profile to the Morley's syrup alone.
Yeah.
And then I think balancing it with, we used Sazerac rye. Mm-hmm. So a little,
which was probably
sharper,
a good choice.
I think that, it's a good balance.
It was unintentional, but with the sweetness of the syrup.
It was not unintentional.
Well, for me, it was unintentional. Maybe it wasn't for you. You were prescient. Yeah, no, like the spice of the rye, I think, really balances the sweetness nicely.
Yeah.
So get yourself some Morley maple syrup. If you go to MorleyMapleSyrup.com, you can order everything there. Get the bourbon maple syrup for sure. Also check out the jalapeno or the regular old maple syrup. Just get yourself a whole bunch.
It's fantastic. Get it for Christmas gifts.
Thank you.
One of the concepts from the book, again, that really has stuck out to me is this concept of the balanced spiritual diet.
Yeah.
And,
The
ways that often we're serving just the easy stuff, the fun stuff, the sugary stuff, especially as worship leaders. But I think that's the temptation as everybody in their spiritual journey is to find those things that are the easiest, the most palatable.
Yep.
Can you just describe that concept a little bit and dig into, I think the alternatives probably go deeply into what we've already discussed, but just help us tie that concept together.
Yeah, that's actually a phrase from my wife. In my years at Mars Hill, we were trying to move from what five songs are we going to sing to what worship communal journey are we going to go on to? And I'm telling you, even just shifting that framing question changed everything, because it wasn't plugging songs into the slot. It was thinking like a story, a narrative. Where are we going to go together? And so once we kind of discerned the story of that Sunday, then we would say, all right, what helps us begin the story? Is there a prayer? Is there a song? Is there a meditation? And a lot of it was still singing, but then we'd do these other things too, things we were learning from our Anglican friends, from our Catholic friends, from our Pentecostal friends. And so my wife, Shauna, was saying, why are we doing all these different things? Why aren't we just singing anymore? And I was trying to explain. And that's when she said, oh, so you're trying to serve us a well-balanced meal every Sunday. And it was so profound for me, because I realized that I had served one kind of meal for the last like 15 years, every Sunday, wondering why the community wasn't getting healthier. To this day, I think it was actually a pretty healthy meal. I don't think it was just junk food, but it was missing some fundamental food groups that we would never, ever engage communally. One obvious one is lament. Almost a third of the Psalms are laments. And do you know what percentage of the top 100 CCLI worship songs are laments? I'll tell you, 0%. It's just not what we do. So you just have to ask, in the same way with food, you know, if a person never ate fiber, what would happen to their diet, you know? Or if you never had calcium, what would happen? Well, I'll tell you what happens with an entire movement that never practices lament in a healthy way. Really, really toxic things. And so, you know, what a loss. And so it made us wonder, like, what else are we missing? And there were a couple other things that surfaced, at least in our community. At that time, we you know, especially early, we never did a confession of sin. That felt Catholic. That felt shameful. But it doesn't have to be. Confessing our sin is naming reality. It's trusting God enough to say, here's what's true. Is grace big enough even for this? And thank God it is. And so we started practicing confession and then receiving a word of assurance. We started praying not just for what was happening in the room or in our community. We started praying for things going on in the world. It sounds really simple, but it shifted that from all that matters is what's happening in these four walls to, you know what? God loves the world, and we're this tiny little part of it. So all these different practices just expanded, brought, you know, again, every analogy breaks down, but brought the different nutrients and this well-balanced diet in, I think, what was a pretty helpful way.
Mm-hmm. So related to what you just said about praying for the world and all the stuff going on in the world, it would seem inconsistent with what you've been describing to stop at a prayer, right? So what role do you think working for like social change and social justice and structural equity, what role does that kind of practice, right? Because it can't be done by thinking or praying about it. What role does that play in Christian practice itself? Is being involved in a concrete, specified way in a political process a feature of church as you envision it?
Yep. I mean, massive, massive question. A couple quick answers, and then we can dive in as deeply as you want to go. I truly think if a church is not political, it is not living out the mandate to love its neighbor as itself. How can we say we love our neighbor and we don't care about the very real issues that are harming them? Mm-hmm. Now, when a church becomes partisan, then all sorts of lunacy starts sneaking in. So I think the distinction between political, which just means having to do with how a society organizes itself, is critical. But partisan, especially these days, is really toxic. So now, how do you discern where one ends and the other one begins? That's truly a matter of discernment. But, you know, I'll just speak from my background. As you know, I've spent most of my life as a white male in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Politics don't affect us very much. We are insulated by our privilege and by the fact that we are overrepresented in almost every power structure. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for us to say, leave the politics out there. But you don't have to get outside of my little bubble very far to realize that these policies profoundly affect so many different layers of life. And so, yeah, can't pretend to love our neighbor if we don't care about the things that affect them.
Yeah, just dig a tiny bit deeper. Can you give maybe an example of how that has worked in your in the practice or in your experience of leading liturgy? Like, what does it look like when you give people tools or help them reframe how they think about it? Or, I mean, I'm guessing you don't say, or maybe you do, here's who you should vote for. But what does it look like specifically for
you? Not that, but I'll tell you what. I was still on staff at Willow and still leading the practice when Donald Trump was elected in 2016. We had been that fall moving through the Beatitudes, and the Sunday after the election was Blessed Are the Peacemakers. So we had 4 days from that election to then gather together. And we had some Trump people in our community who were really excited and celebrating that day. We had some people who were just, you know, devastated and really scared for the country. And then we had a number of people in between just saying, I don't know what to do with all this. But I thought, man, of course I'm not going to choose a partisan one against the other. But we're going to engage this head on. And so we talked about the trying to put ourselves in each other's shoes. We had one of the members of our community is a fiery, prophetic, wonderful Latina woman. And she just said, can I tell you what it's been like in my community with this kind of rhetoric? And we actually asked her to write a prophetic prayer. And then we asked Father Michael to write a priestly prayer because we feel like both are desperately necessary. The priests help us see each other, helps us come together, helps us be a part of this together. And then the prophet names the painful reality. And so we wanted to hold both of those together. And so, yeah, did I ever tell someone who to vote for? Of course not. Would anyone have any question how I felt about the rhetoric of our current president? Absolutely not.
And by current, you mean
that
Trump.
Yeah, in 2016.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But presumably if you were still leading it, the same would be the case today, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, after Biden was sworn in the most I was horrified by the Democratic use of Christian themes and language to talk about our nation. Mm-hmm. So if you say you're not partisan, but you only critique one side, you're partisan. And that's okay. You're allowed to be. But are there values that are bigger? I hated how Trump used Christian language for his bigotry. And I hated the inauguration of Biden, all the Christian-y language for this our very secular superpower. So, you know, we try to name what we see not as partisans, but as like Christians, as members of a different kingdom. Yeah. So
our listeners are well acquainted with our thoughts on these things.
Yeah.
So yeah, I won't pile on.
That's surprising.
I'm curious. So this book came out about 3 years ago, and it's maybe the understatement of the century to say a good deal has happened since then. Socially, personally, for you.
Yeah.
I'm curious, if you were to write the book today, what would be different about it? Have you changed your mind about anything? Would you have focused more on some things than others?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this. I haven't talked a lot about this. I'm going to share it probably at some point. But I wrote a chapter that we ended up cutting last minute. And it was the second to last chapter. And it was literally arguing against the whole book. And it was basically, the title was, "Or Maybe We Should Just Burn It All Down." And I thought it was an interesting, both rhetorically, like, let's talk about both sides of this. You know, I'm painting this vision for what could be that I still believe. And I have doubts. I started with a story of, remember John Lennon in the song Revolution? When you talk about destruction, you can count me out. But on the White Album, he said, when you talk about destruction, you can help me in.
Yeah.
And his explanation later was, well, I'm not always sure. And so I think if I was writing it today, it's kind of embarrassing to admit, if I flip through the book, I still believe in this stuff so deeply. I'm still trying to flesh it out in ways. But I think I would probably talk a little more. I think less renovation and more, it's all burning to the ground. What are we going to build out of the rubble? So I think maybe 3 years ago, I thought, yeah, we're going to have to put on a new roof. I mean, it's going to be some real deep renovations. And now I think, no, I think it's going to be total loss. But then what? Then what's possible? And so that's probably where I'm at. Right.
Yeah. Now. Thanks. Quick aside, just because philosophy is half of our podcast. You mentioned at least a couple of philosophers that I noticed in the book, Dallas Willard, who came up earlier, but also James K. Smith.
Yep.
Do you want to say anything about how those guys' thought informed you and maybe shaped how you think about Christian practice?
Well, I can't overstate Dallas Willard. I think it's not hyperbole to say I don't think I would be a Christian without his book, The Divine Conspiracy. And some of it was the timing, and you know how so much of books and ideas are timing in life, but his vision of the kingdom was truly revolutionary. And a lot of people don't know this, but Rob Bell planted Mars Hill in his living room reading through The Divine Conspiracy. So that was like their core text too, and just a really monumental book. And then Jamie Smith, when I read Desiring the Kingdom, I don't know if that was how many years ago, 7 or 8. Do you know when that book came out?
Oh, I don't know. But it's been a little while now.
Yeah, that was just absolutely so critical with the whole idea that we are being shaped by liturgies of all kinds. It's not about, are we being shaped by liturgies? It's about how are we being shaped? So the shopping mall is a liturgy.
Yeah.
And our practices at home are a liturgy.
I had a similar experience with him. Like anytime now I hear someone, and we kind of do this at our church sometimes, we'll refer to, oh, we're going to have a liturgical prayer now or a liturgical reading.
Yeah.
And I think everything we've been doing is liturgy. The whole thing. Yeah.
Yep. For my whole life, you know, as a worship leader, we had a very set liturgy. We had loud song. Louder song, really loud song, and then we had offering, announcements, a sermon, and then an earnest song. Well, that's a liturgy, and it's not a bad liturgy. There's a lot of beauty to that. I would probably argue it's missing some things that need to be supplemented, but we are all liturgical beings.
So, Aaron, you have referenced a couple times your time at Willow Creek, and our listeners are familiar because of a church called Tove with all that went down there.
Yeah.
And obviously you're very affected by it. The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast has become this crazy phenomenon.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy phenomenon.
Yeah.
And in it, you can hear the tension that many at Mars Hill...
The other Mars Hill, let's be clear.
The other Mars Hill. Yeah, yes, yes.
I always try to make that really clear. Yeah. I was part of the Grand Rapids Mars Hill. Yeah. Not... Yeah.
Oh, and so did Driscoll. He tried to make that clear too.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. He did not want to be confused.
No.
Yep.
But you can hear in some of those interviews the tension that people would have of like, we're seeing beautiful things happen. We're seeing quote unquote kingdom fruit. And this is that really deceptive quote unquote kingdom fruit where we're seeing all these people being baptized and coming to Jesus. Yep. We're in the most unchurched city in the world, nation, and all this is happening, blah, blah, blah. But yet they could feel it. They could sense the misogyny. They could sense the patriarchy. Yep. They could sense the abusive,
the
bullying.
Cruelty.
Yeah, all of it. Yep. And eventually it just went over the top, you know?
Yep.
You were in a similar environment, it seems like, where, you know, maybe not as clear and in your face. But, I mean, there, you know, you had similar dynamics. And eventually the Chicago Tribune took hold of it. And, you know, what happened happened. How did that feel? Did you have that similar tension that we hear in that podcast of those people of like, I don't like this, but good things are still happening. What was that like?
Yeah. Oh man. Well, let me start in my head and then I'll share a little bit. You know, there's two truths. Like Rob Bell used to say, if you ever find a perfect church, don't join it because you'll wreck it. So, I mean, there really are two truths. Churches are only humans, and we humans are so deeply flawed. And so there is a brokenness almost necessary to a church because it's broken humans who are making it up. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, we are seeing, such a devastating, example of toxicity that just is like a cancer from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not that kind of dangerous, toxic thing is not what we're talking about in the first truth. Well, we're all broken, you know, saved by grace. That's something really, really dangerous.
Right. Yeah.
And so,
maybe being specific would help, right? We're all broken in a general, powerful sense, but we're not all sexual abusers and we're not all racist. And we're not all, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And yet we all have broken parts to our sexual history and we all have broken things we're trying to work through in terms of race and diversity. So I don't know if it's, there are the bad people and the not so bad people. I think what happens is the structures get built that then empower the worst tendencies in people.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of things that my brokenness gets exposed and then I have a chance to heal. We see in both Mars Hill and Willow, we see these impenetrable structures where power is consolidated into, it's always one dude, and everybody loses.
Yeah. Did you see that when you were there? Did you recognize that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, what we said is we saw the culture of fear. Everybody was afraid.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the lack of truth telling to power. I mean, there was so little of that. We saw all that stuff. We never saw the sexual. That was such a devastating, horrifying surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I'll probably never get over that. Mm-hmm. That is a disillusionment and a horror that just, But that was not in our awareness. Mm-hmm. But the power stuff, the just trail of dead bodies behind Willow for 40 years. Mm-hmm. I had a therapist friend who he had his practice in the Chicagoland area, and he said, well, Willow keeps me in business.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
Think about that.
Yep.
That church is so dangerous to people's souls that therapists have thriving business if they're close by.
Yeah. Elliot knows something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we're talking, I'm sure there's a few people who are listening who are in an environment like this, and they're like, holy shit, yeah. This might be my church.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts or, you know, like advice for someone who is recognizing there's some toxic things going on here? How do I address this? Do I just leave?
Yeah. In my 20s especially, I was like, man, if it doesn't align perfectly to everything you think, you get out of there and you find a place to be fully yourself. And, mm-hmm. you know, and in my 30s, that widened quite a bit to, you know, life knocks you around a little bit. You realize that everything is complicated. And wherever you go, there you are. And so the idea that every time I'm in a place that I'm unhappy, it's that they're all idiots, mm-hmm. and I'm going to find the utopia. I think a lot of us chase the utopia, and I don't think it exists. So that's the first half of the answer. Mm-hmm. The second half of the answer is, once you discern that there is something cancerous in the culture, you need to get out that afternoon. So I have stories working in churches for so many years. I have so many friends, and some of them left a little too early, but most would say they stayed way too late. Mm-hmm. And some of it was really believing and hoping.
Yeah.
Some of it was fear and probably 100 other reasons. But so I would say this is a question that you have to work through with your spiritual director, with the people who know you the best. Mm-hmm. I had to admit to my wife once, you know what? I'm on the third boss where I'm having the same problem with the third boss in a row.
Yikes.
Is it possible it's not just all three are idiots? Mm-hmm. Is it possible that there is some, you know, wherever you go, there you are?
Yeah.
So I think that is the first question of discernment. But once you've got to the point where you're like, hey, there's a toxicity here. There is a narcissism, especially a institutionalized narcissism that protects, you know, the whole thing that we're seeing in all of these places. Mm-hmm. I think you get out that afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just add that, like, the problem is compounded by the fact that many people's spiritual advisors in those contexts are just part of the harmful system.
Oh, so, my, of course.
You're going to have to be willing to look outside your culture,
yep.
maybe even your entire tradition, to figure out, to discern, as you put it, whether this is that kind of toxic thing or something that's worth sticking it out. And if you're in a culture that frowns on or is even hostile to the attempt to do that, that's a pretty good indication that you might be in one of those toxic cultures.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And I would say that's to find a therapist and a spiritual director outside of your real narrow circle, I think is just good practice mm-hmm. in any context. Mm-hmm. If only just to approach questions and practices and ideas from a different vantage point.
Yep. I don't think I'd be continuing doing what I'm doing if I didn't have that myself. Yeah.
No. Nor would I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last question about Willow and the whole deal. In Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger's book, A Church Called Tove, they obviously center a lot on the Willow experience. They were part of it. Yep. And in a conversation we had on this podcast, they make a pretty good case that it seems as if Willow really didn't use that crisis moment to reform and change their culture and change and do some self-reflection and repentance. I mean, just seeing the reaction, it was like doubling down after doubling down. And then all of a sudden you had, you get the job description for the new senior pastor, and it looks pretty much like a Bill Hybels clone. They make the case that pretty much nothing has changed. They've just all lumped all that crap onto Hybels' shoulders and not taken owned any of it. You were part of that community for a long time. Would you, that's a common thing, but would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I read Tove and thought it was, I mean, obviously so painful and brilliant. I highly recommend it. I think they did a really nice job. I'll say this, you know, I didn't see almost any self-reflection at almost any level. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. I didn't see any of it. But it's hard to comment because really once, when we realized, you know, I had already left staff when this all broke.
Did you?
Thank God.
Wow.
Because if I would have had to lead our community through that, that would have just been, it was already so, let me tell a quick just human story. The week that happened, when the Tribune ran the first story and we all found out what had been happening, I was at, you know, Walgreens or something with my kid. He was probably 12 at the time. And he walked and he kind of wandered away as I was paying. And then he was over by the newspaper stands and he's like, "Hey, look, Papa's on the newspaper." And I just remember thinking, this is so, I don't even have a category. What do I tell my kid? What do I, how do I wade into this? There's a private side that obviously we're going to take to the far, you know, go all the way with. What do you do publicly? Like, is that, do you talk about those kinds of things? It was so off the chart of knowing how to engage that whole thing. But I bring that all up just to say we have not tried to stay connected to the institutional side of what's going on at Will. So I really can't comment on are they doing things differently or the same. But I'll say I have not seen a overwhelming amount of self-reflection.
Thanks for going there with us, Aaron.
Yeah.
So speaking of, I mean, talking about how much life has changed for you, for Shauna, for your family, as you look back on your ministry life, Aaron, I mean, where you've worked, you've been inside the belly of the beast twice, right? Like two humongous, well-known, world globally influential mega churches. And now all of a sudden you're away from that and you're in Chelsea and I am so jealous in some ways, but, and you have, and more of a high church setting in smaller environments. What do you and Shauna imagine and dream about in this next season of your lives when you think about church and ministry? Are there things that you'd like to hold on to, anything, or what would you never want to go back to? What do you guys talk about and dream about?
First of all, to just say, we don't know. 10 years from now, who knows? So that there's not a master plan. What I know is I am experiencing so much life in some of the intersections. And so I don't think I would ever go back to only one stream. I'm really interested and compelled by what happens, I guess, like Ghostbusters, right? When you cross the stream. When multiple traditions mingle together, when multiple perspectives, cultures, it's really, really compelling to me. Now, what I have to name is one of those streams really is evangelicalism. And there's a lot from evangelicalism that I've had to let go of and just say, you know, maybe that worked for a while. Maybe it never did. Maybe it was always toxic, but I'm going to have to, you know, bless it and let it go. But there are other parts of the tradition that A, are just part of my story and always will be. Like, you don't erase the past. In the same way, I'll always be a Nyquist. Like, that's just how I came into the world. But also, there are some things about the tradition that I think are really, really beautiful, but they're not enough. That's what I've come to believe. Evangelicalism has some really good parts, but it's just not enough on its own. And so, so I think the future for me, at least what I deeply desire, is to hold on to some of these evangelical roots, but bring them into a wider and deeper space.
Fun. Couple of two rivers or streams coming together, as it were, I guess. I mean, somebody should write a book named Eternal Currents.
Yeah. If only.
Yeah.
Someday.
So when you and I were sharing lunch together, Aaron, this past summer on the rooftop in New York, you mentioned something similar to what you're talking about, of your desire, your dream kind of taking... I don't remember exactly what it was from Episcopalian, you know, high church of, I think it was like, I want to take the theology and liturgy of Episcopalianism and mix it with the hospitality, I think it was, of evangelicalism and see what happens out of that synergy.
No, that's pretty close. Evangelical hospitality with Anglican, I think I said sacramental imagination.
Yes, there you go.
And then the third stream, though, is Jesuit spiritual practice.
Okay.
And what I love about it is the evangelical impulse is to like include you, like join mm-hmm. us, be a part mm-hmm. of this. Not only do we want you to be a part of it, but once you're here, we'll help you do it. You know, there's an energy, there's a life, there's a vibrancy. It matters. Like, and it doesn't just matter in my brain, it matters in my heart, it matters in my body. That's something I never want to lose mm-hmm. from healthy streams of evangelical worship and experience. The problem is we didn't always have very much content. Like, it was about an inch thin in cases. So we got ourselves all worked up and we love Jesus, but that was about, that's where it went. And so, you know, now, you know, my last couple of years here at General Theological Seminary, I got to worship in a very high church Episcopalian context, and the depth of the liturgy, the weight, the beauty of the words, the sacramental imagination of what's happening at the table, it was all so rich. Now, half the people seemed asleep the whole time. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to stand and yell, do you realize the treasures that you are sitting on? And so it just made me think, how do we bring these? Why do we have to choose? Why does it have to be exciting and dumb or thoughtful and ice cold? Yeah. Why do we have to choose? We don't. And so the idea of bringing those streams together is really compelling from a gathering standpoint. And then I think what the Jesuit Ignatian spirituality offers then is a path. How do I actually live this out? Hmm. And Ignatian spirituality offers the practices and the framework for a daily lived practice. So that's what I'm, man... When I get really fired up, it's thinking about how those three streams come
new together. New Church Network brought to you by Aaron Nyquist.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's a cocktail. Yes. This is the old,
work on that.
The old spirit plus the... Uh-huh.
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
So, Aaron, obviously everyone likes putting people into boxes and categories. You've just been talking about how you want to become a mongrel, you know, within Christendom. Yeah. How would you identify if someone had to nail you to the wall? Do you identify anymore as an evangelical?
It's a weird question.
Sorry.
what I don't identify as an ex-evangelical, just because I don't want to be an ex-anything. Yeah. It's not that I don't want to leave things. I just don't want to define myself by what I'm not. So I don't use ex-evangelical. I think I am still rooted in some of the evangelical tradition, some of the things I learned. So in that way, I want to give a yes, but I am categorically not what American evangelical has become. Mm-hmm. So then I'm categorically not that. So that's where it's I'm not trying to do a cop-out answer. You know, you'd have to start by, okay, what do you mean by evangelical, mm-hmm. right? So I'm not an ex. I'm not anti. I did a chapter in the book called Include and Transcend. I'm trying to hold on to every bit of my past that can be life-giving. Yeah. And
That's good. Our church dropped the evangelical label about, I don't know, a year and a half ago. And we just decided to just simplify and call ourselves a Christian church following in the way of Jesus.
Christian church. Yeah.
It's that simple.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Because evangelical is as much a political term now as it is a religious one. So, and it's just not helpful. Yep. Yeah. It's not descriptive anymore for what it used to mean.
Well, Aaron Nyquist, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your time. This has been enlightening. I'm sure listeners are going to love it. Where can they find you online if they want to find out more?
Yeah, I've everything is just at my website, which is just my name, aaronnyquist.com. So I'm on all the socials and all that, usually Aaron Neek, one N. If you want to check out the book, if you want to check out the new liturgy project, if you want to check out the podcast, which is called Eternal Current Podcast, you can find all the links.
Awesome. We'll put those in the show notes as well.
AaronNyquist.com. Yep. Yep.
Awesome. Aaron, thank you for joining us. Cheers, my friend.
Cheers to you.
I loved what he said about, which I guess he was borrowing from the people he named that he had read, but I loved what he said about the Eucharist and how it forms your practice. He quoted the guy.
Ian Crum.
Yeah.
Ian Crum.
Yeah. What was the quote?
It was, you don't take communion.
Right. You receive it.
The Eucharist is something that you receive.
It's like a Mr. Miyagi moment, right? Yeah. it's so profound when you think about the application of it, because you're doing this semi-rote thing. And I grew up in a tradition where that was what we were formed around as well. It was Protestant, but that was the whole idea, is open communion, and we do it every week, and it's the center of every service.
I didn't know that.
You do kind of, I don't know, you've without realizing it, muscle memory, right? You form this orientation towards the world and towards other people by making that the center of your practice, kind of like taking your jacket off and putting it back on over and over again. Yeah, it's like this judo move or something. It's cool.
I mean there's a lot more there, and I think the liturgy is what's missing in a lot of evangelical feeling spaces. That without actually engaging and speaking and saying words that are speaking to what's happening here in this moment, it does become just like this, I don't see what the big deal is, you know, or moment of like, oh, I got to repent of that sin. I, you know, lusted over and over again this week, rather than being something that, again, you receive, that you ingest and digest, and it transforms you from, you know, your inner man out, and you're partaking in something that Christ has not just done 2000 years ago, but is doing in the world on a continually greater basis, you know? Yeah, it's fun.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please rate and review the podcast before you close your app. You can also share the episode with friends or family members with the links from our social media pages. Gain inside access, extra perks, and more at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. We're so grateful for your support of the podcast. Until next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.